Right. We marginally delayed the beginning because there were so many people who wanted to come in. So I'd like to welcome everyone to this fourth lecture in the Miliband program on inequality, dimensions, and challenges. The Miliband program was set up by an ex-student of the LSE who was inspired very much by Ralph Miliband's contribution to social thought. And the donor wishes to continue Ralph Miliband's intellectual tradition, and particularly he wishes to advance the spirit of free social inquiry. So this is a Miliband event, but it's also co-sponsored by the LSE Gender Institute, and we're delighted ourselves to be able to celebrate our 10th year of existence. And in that vein, tonight's lecture is on gender inequality, old patterns and new challenges. And we have two very distinguished speakers, and they have qualities and have done things that many people in this position or speaking from this platform have not done in their life, in the sense that they've experienced the life of low-paid workers in a variety of different areas. Barbara Ehrenreich, on my extreme left, as it happens, is a social critic and a regular columnist for The Progressive, but she's also the author of Nickel and Dimed, which recently won the Puffin Nation Prize. More recently, she's tackled those same kind of issues of low pay on a global scale together with Arlie Hochschild. And then on my immediate left here, we have Polly Toynbee, who's a political and social commentator for The Guardian and so very well known to many of us. She won a prize for being the Political Journalist of the Year in 1993, and is also author of Hard Work, Life, and in Low-Paid Britain. And she also has a new book coming out on Monday, Better or Worse, Did Labour Deliver? So I think we all want to know the answer to that question. We might have our own thoughts. What we've done is we've asked both speakers to speak for about 20 minutes, and then we'll open discussion up for each of them to ask each other questions and to have questions from the floor. So without more from me, I'd like to ask Polly to begin the lecture. Thank you.
Thank you very much. There are things that the Labour government does talk about and things that it doesn't ever talk about. These spoken things and these profound silences are very significant for the long-term success or failure of what is probably what most members of this government would say and feel is why they're in politics and what makes them get up in the morning, to produce a fairer society, one where every child from every background, boy or girl, has a better chance of fulfilling their potential and living a good life. The inequalities, in fact, that are the theme of these lectures in honour of Ralph Miliband. Gender inequality is one of the things that the government does talk about. The still wide gap in pay and opportunities between men and women worries them. There's a women's minister, there's a women's unit, attention is paid to the Equal Opportunities Commission. There are more women MPs on Labour's backbenches than ever before, still only 23%. But they do agitate, have agitated pretty effectively on women's issues, winning some important battles. But the official pay gap remains hardly moving at near 18% between women and men's pay. And the real pay gap is far wider than that. The one between the hourly rate of pay for a part-time woman, nearly half of all women at work are part-timers, and the full-time rate for men, which is most of men at work. And that gap, which reflects the common reality, is 40% and hasn't changed at all. This has worried all governments, conservative as well, as each social security minister delves into their budget and realises that inequality in pay burns the biggest hole in their pocket. If women can't earn enough to care for themselves and their children, then the state ends up as breadwinner for large numbers of families one way or another. And until women can earn a living wage for their families, it's the state that will always pick up the bill for the difference. Tax credits may have offered the best ever redistribution of money to families with children, many of them lone parent families, but they're also phenomenally expensive. And so are benefits for mothers not in work, for lack of good affordable childcare, or not good enough care for elderly parents. And when the majority of women grow old, few of them have built up a pension they can live on, and the gender pay gap for pensioners is 41%. And so the state ends up picking up the bill for their old age too, paying twice over for a lifetime of unequal pay. All of this worries governments, and Labour has done more than any other to try to remedy it. Or rather, they've done a great deal to alleviate its effects, which is rather different. Apart from the direct transfers of cash into the pockets of mothers, they've made very little headway with the fundamental inequality in women's pay that causes taxpayers to have to reach into their pockets to plug the gap with benefits and credits. What are the fundamental causes? It's not education. We know girls do ever better than boys. 11% more girls now get 5 good GCSEs. What other causes? It's motherhood, certainly. But even that isn't a sufficient explanation. Shocking research findings from the government's own women's unit show how women's low pay starts from the day that they leave school or university and take their first job. And overall, single women without children are paid on average 14% less than single men. But above all, the underlying story is not essentially about gender. It's about the nature of the labour market out there and the way that inequality was let rip in the last 25 years that explains the gender pay gap. In a very unequal world where among developed nations, America is virtually the only one more unequal than Britain, the weakest will always sink to the bottom first. It's hard to imagine how this gender pay gap can be bridged without addressing the greater rich and poor pay gap itself. Trying to redress the injustice of women's pay on its own by somehow changing what jobs women do has proven to be an economically and sociologically improbable endeavour. What happens out there in the wild west of the labour market is one of the things the government most adamantly refuses to speak about. They may worry about the status and pay of women, but they have nothing at all to say about the nature of the markets that relegate women and women's work to a subsurvivable pay grade. There is an omerta, an absolutely zipped lip on questions of how much people should be paid, why they're rewarded as they are, what is enough, and even more silence as to what is too much. Back in the 1970s, when Barbara Castle pushed through the Equal Pay Act and Sex Discrimination Act, we who had fought hard for these celebrated mightily. That was it, problem solved. Women would break through every glass ceiling, and to some extent they did. Glass ceilings were shattered by handfuls of women, and there are no no-go areas anymore. We even had a woman prime minister. We thought the answer now was to spend all of our energies on getting women into non-traditional areas. So new organisations sprang up to promote it, attempting to network women into male zones, lecture girls on becoming plasterers and builders. There was women in business, women in engineering, women in science. Rosie the Riveter was the totemic movie of the time. But 30 years later, nothing much has changed. For most women at work, it didn't happen. There are more women plumbers than there were, but they're still pretty remarkable, like women London taxi drivers. Essentially, job segregation in a wide range of occupations remains set in aspect, so that modern apprenticeships, as they're now called, are not really very modern. Almost all those doing apprenticeships in hairdressing, early years, care and education, are young women destined to low pay, while almost all those doing construction, engineering and plumbing are men destined to higher rewards. Doesn't really matter whether it's nature or nurture. 30 years has been a long time to learn this hard lesson, but too short a time to change things that seem to be embedded so deep. Where this matters most is not in counting the thin numbers of women in the boardrooms. That may matter too. It matters where it's a matter of survival for the majority of women in low-paid work. There, women are still trapped in traditional women's occupations, mainly the four C's: catering, cleaning, caring, cash registers. These are low status and low pay. But why? It's curiously and hideously circular. They're low-paid jobs because they're the jobs that women do. 70% of low-paid work is done by women. That meant the overwhelming majority of those helped by introducing a minimum wage were women. But the minimum wage, still after 8 years of labour, is only £4.85 an hour, when a living wage would be somewhere around the £6.50 mark, just about survivable for an adult and two children. The ranks of the low paid have swelled hugely in recent years. The biggest single group of the poor are not any longer the old, not the unemployed, they're the low paid, in work, some of them in two or even three jobs, great growing armies of them. There are more of the low paid every year. The government praises itself for getting so many more people into work, but work is not necessarily, in fact, is quite rarely for a lot of these people, the passport out of poverty. However, for the women who are the great bulk of the low paid, work is a passport to tax credits, and as a result, a better standard of living. It's hard grind, while still essentially state-dependent, with very little chance of betterment and promotion in most of those jobs, and especially for those who, because of children, have taken part-time jobs for several years and lose whatever seniority they might have earned. What happens next? When their youngest child leaves school, they lose the tax credits that might have made those jobs worthwhile. They fall off a cliff edge in income. There is nothing for them to look forward to except an old age on minimum pension credit. Those who suffer most from Britain's great inequality in pay are women and children, and the children are scarred by it for life in every piece of research about their future life chances. So the story of gender inequality is largely the story of Britain's deep inequality. The great mistake we made back in the 1970s was to expect to move women into men's jobs and better themselves that way. And it's now quite plain it isn't going to happen anytime soon. Nor are men in the near future going to move in large numbers into women's jobs as we'd hoped, knowing that if they did, they would have demanded higher pay and higher status if they'd taken up the mops and the saucepans. So the only hope is for women's work to be properly and fairly valued. There is no rhyme or reason in why jobs are rewarded as they are, high pay or low pay. There is no obvious market rate that fixes the price for most jobs. There is for some, quite transparently, but not for a great many of them. Cartels and ancient traditions operate to establish what is the going rate, for the most part, regardless of any sensible reason why. Why is the care assistant caring for six or eight utterly helpless old people night and day, earning just £4.85 an hour, when they're in short supply? Care homes are often short-staffed, especially in the southeast. Certainly there's no surplus. The market doesn't operate because care homes fix the set price and refuse to compete with one another over what rates to pay their staff. Why is the chief executive earning 100 times as much? No obvious market forces are at work there either, according to the research of the Work Foundation. There is virtually no external market for his skills. In Britain, virtually none of the FTSE 250 top CEOs are foreign, and there's not much sign of demand for British CEOs abroad. While a lot of others are competing for his job, and if he fell under a bus, his shoes would be filled quite effortlessly. So how well does the sacred market operate there? If this were a genuine market, the care assistant whose skills are in much more demand would see her pay soar, while the CEO would see his deflate. Doesn't happen. Talking to supermarket managers in the course of researching my book, they agree that they agree quite openly, they all keep pay within an area for their checkout and shelf stacking staff low, despite an acute shortage, again, particularly in the southeast, because if one shop raised their rate, all the others would too, and then in one manager's words, we'd all be back where we started. Now, what kind of free market thinking is that? It amounts to an instinctive, automatic conspiracy to resist the market and keep pay low. It's almost a conspiracy of a slave-owning mentality. And this happens most in the low-paid women's sector. There's a flat refusal to upgrade the value of what women do because women do it. It doesn't count as a skill to cook or clean or wash or feed old people or care for babies in nurseries or wash and cut hair, make sandwiches or assist children in the classroom. These things ordain the makers of the market, who are mostly male. These are the things that women do naturally. These days, well-trained managers may not admit it, even to themselves, that that's the way they think, but they still do. Our mothers did these things for us, for free, for love. You can't put a price on love and service, can you? So they don't. Mixed with that notion of primeval nurturing, the primeval nurturing nature of women, there is something really quite nasty too. It's an instinctive, institutionalized contempt for women and all that they do. And that melds into an institutional contempt for children too, and for the business of taking care of their needs. All this is low skill, low pay, low grade, near worthless work, iced over very often with lashings of sickly sentiment. Everyone loves children. Everyone pays for those who care for them the lowest wages of all. I know there are usually some men doing those jobs too. Few workplaces are 100% segregated, but when men do push brooms or wash up in school kitchens or wash and feed old men in care homes, they are regarded as essentially women too. Worse for them in a way, they become emasculated, relegated down amongst the most despised, even without the status veneer of being warm and kindly motherly types who do the work for love. In my book, Hard Work, published last year, following very much in the footsteps of Barbara's brilliant and far more shocking American experiences in Nickel and Dime, I too explored the world of low-paid work in Britain. And I took jobs as they came up from the Brixton Job Centre. I was a dinner lady, a hospital cleaner, a hospital porter, a nursery assistant, a cake packer, and a telesales operator. I had a comparison to make with another book that I'd written at the start of my journalistic career back in the early 1970s, when I took a number of low-paid jobs as well and wrote a book about it. In those days, it was mostly in factories. By chance, very journalistic good luck, this time I was sent back to the same hospital in the same grade of job that I had done 30 years before. And it gave me a chance to make a real-life assessment of what's happened to pay in that time. In those 30 years, the nation is more than twice as rich as it was, more than double the per capita income, if that is, incomes were actually shared out equally per capita. When I took my first payslip to the Institute for Fiscal Studies to calculate how it compared, they found that in real terms, I was now being paid £36 a week less than I was over 30 years ago. Now, that came as a shock to me. I thought perhaps it won't have gone up much. I didn't expect that in real terms it would have fallen back by that degree. But that's what's happened. We talk in an abstract way about how inequality mushroomed in the 1980s and 90s, and some debate about whether it matters at all. People only compare themselves with those just above and those just below. What does it matter to them if an upper tier far away shoots out of sight through the roof? But this payslip shows what actually happened. Growing numbers of people were left behind, held down, while others soared ahead. It meant a yawning chasm opening up between what's now the 70% of homeowners doing quite well and the 30% with nothing, most of them with hardly 2 weeks' savings in the bank. Labour's only managed to stop that inequality growing any worse on its watch by shovelling tax credits into the pockets of poor families to compensate them. Generous, but in the end, no answer to the forces still tugging in the wrong direction. Other European countries chose not to let the market rip during those last two decades. So France and Germany have fairer societies. Nordic countries, Holland, fairest of all, with virtually no poverty. All this they did through political choice. And societies, just like ours, making quite different political decisions. It wasn't economic good luck. Though, as it happens, those in Europe who chose social democratic fairness in the post-war decades seem to have had the greatest economic success as well. Low pay is the single largest cause of women's inequality. It's not impossible to put it right. The minimum wage could rise considerably, despite dire predictions from employers, Every time it's raised, jobs continue to be created, not destroyed. And it's not impossible to hold down the obscene rates of pay at the top either. Other countries do it. Deciding that women really will have equal pay for work of equal value would require every employer to carry out a regular pay review, but that could be done too. New guidelines could be set for valuing the work that women do. The state is in a strong position to lead the way. Once you look at the question of equality through the perspective of women's pay, perhaps it's easier for the government to dare to approach these things that frighten it most, the fear of being thought egalitarian. It has found that tackling child poverty is a reasonably comfortable political concept. In the name of children, it's engaged in major cash redistribution without frightening itself too much. If it thought about pay and women, it might find another politically palatable way to approach the destructive and inexplicable general pay differentials. Labour's very keen on being seen to save taxpayers' money. We've seen the debates on incapacity benefit this week. So it might be a good idea to point out that subsidising employers who pay too little is very hard on taxpayers' pockets. After all, if tax credits were withdrawn, all the low-paid mothers would have to leave work at once and return to living on Social Security. They could only afford to take jobs at these rock-bottom rates of pay because of the state subsidy, and the employers largely ignore that. But why should we let them get away with it? Their businesses thrive unrealistically in a market that is now grossly distorted by these hidden state handouts and subsidies. Anyone paying below £6.50 an hour is operating at the taxpayer's expense if they're employing somebody with a family. It might even be a question for EU competition law. Now, of course, I'm not really criticising tax credits, which have lifted over 1 million children out of poverty and their mothers with them. The point is the artificial state of what is called a market in pay. 80% of people tell British Social Attitudes that they regard Britain as far too unequal. It's time the question of just rewards for women and for men, for work of all kinds, entered into a serious political debate. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Polly, for that account of UK society today. So let's move to the US and Barbara Ehrenreich. Thank you.
Thank you. And can you hear me? And I want to also thank the Ralph Miliband Lecture Series for inviting me here and inviting me for the privilege of sharing the platform with someone I very much admire, and that is Polly. I want to start with the issue of gender and inequality, which has most consumed my time and energy for some time, and that is welfare reform, which was passed in the United States in 1996. And you probably know our form of welfare was just for single mothers. You know, it was not for the unemployed generally or anything. And the law that was passed in 96 ended the single mothers and their children's entitlement to any kind of cash support for the government. Everybody has to go out and get a job, you know, whether or not you have child care or whatever. I give you just a vivid example of how this works. This is from a woman I met in Oregon last year who had fled from an abusive husband. And she fled with her three children in the car, drove to another town, and showed up on a Friday afternoon at the welfare office. Of course, this is now reformed welfare. She said, I've got three hungry children. I've got no place for them to sleep except the car, and I need help. She was told, and this is welfare reform, she was told, come back Monday and we'll help you find a job. You know, that's what happened to welfare. I should mention the Bush administration has added an interesting new twist to welfare reform. They have actually discovered the solution to poverty among women, and that is marriage. I don't know, it never worked for me, but it would work if Bush was going to draft CEOs to marry women in poverty. Not that these CEOs are all exactly marriage material, but... But, you know, this is completely nonsense. Of course, most women marry men of their own or a similar social class, which means if you're a woman who's had to turn to welfare at various points in your life for some kind, you know, some kind of interim help, you're probably looking at blue-collar men, which is a group that has seen their wages fall fairly dramatically in the United States in the last 20 years. So I once sat down to calculate how many blue-collar men a woman has to marry to lift her out of poverty, and it is a number greater than two. I don't want to be, you know, I don't want you to think that I'm too much leaning in the anti-Republican way, so let me just point out that the original welfare reform bill was signed by Bill Clinton. And this bill contained a $100 million provision for, quote, chastity education for low-wage, low-income women. This is all based on the theory, and I don't know if it's been as strong here as it has been in the United States, that poverty is essentially a character disorder. It's caused by depraved lifestyles, laziness, promiscuity, addiction, and so forth. But anyway, picture the scene. Here's Bill Clinton signing a bill requiring chastity training for poor women. But the big theme of welfare reform is, of course, if you can't get a husband or you don't want a husband, and, of course, the majority of women who show up at welfare offices in dire need do so, what impels them is fleeing from an abusive man. So anyway, they haven't seemed to realize that in Washington. But if you can't get a husband or you don't want one, you have to get a job. Again, the question should be, how many? The average hourly wage of women who have left welfare in the United States since 1996 is $7 an hour. And I just think about the math here. And this is something I had to think about when I worked on, did the research for my book, Nickel and Dimed. You know, is that I made $7, I averaged $7 an hour too. Now that is $1,200 a month. Let's not even take out any money for taxes. Let's assume you're going to be lucky enough to get some kind of tax credit back, but that would still be probably no more than, less than $100 a month. Rent is going to be very conservatively $500 a month, even for one room. Child care. If you go for a licensed child care center that has some kind, you know, some has somehow been approved by the state, that is going to be minimally $500 a month. So you are in negative numbers pretty much before you've bought groceries at that rate. I just want to say a little more on the child care issue, which looms so large for so many single mothers particularly, but working mothers in general. There are in the United States some government subsidies for women coming off of welfare or very poor women, you know, to get them into the workforce. However, it is estimated that only 1/7 of the eligible women actually get these subsidies, meaning that 86% do not get any help. This means that a lot of women are turning to informal and usually extremely scary and substandard child care, like a relative who may not want to take care of your child but, you know, is home and will do it. Or the woman down the street who takes in a whole passel of children and watches them while you work. This has led to some tragedies, and I don't think there's been enough kind of putting together the price of this neglect of child care. If you saw the movie Bowling for Columbine, there's a case in there of a little boy whose mother had been reformed off of welfare. She had no child care, so she leaves the little boy her brother? I don't remember. But somebody who's not, like, you know, not a very responsible person. The little boy finds a gun on the counter and shoots and kills one of his little playmates. Now that is a tragedy from welfare reform. Or this in New York City last August, a six-month-old baby was in a daycare center, was killed in his crib when the other children, the toddlers, decided it would be fun to throw stuffed animals on him in his crib, and they threw so many that he suffocated. This is a case where there was only one adult caregiver for a dozen children, toddlers and infants. That's not possible. You know, takes us back to, what were they called, the medieval institution of just giving unwanted babies to the church, which would kill them for you. So there's a very bleak choice for low-income mothers now. You can do your best to support your children, which is going to mean two jobs. You know, this is for single mothers particularly. And that means seeing so little of your children that for all practical purposes you're neglecting them. Or you could stay home with your children, which is remember that used to be what we were told a good woman did. Stay home with her children when they were little. Except that today, you'll just stay home to watch them starve. So the overall effect of welfare reform, the politicians in America love to boast about it. It was such a success because it got so many people off of welfare. You know, it worked that way. And in fact, about 60% of those women did get jobs, but at wages that condemned them to continued poverty, if not actual destitution and homelessness. Instead of ending poverty, as it was supposed to do, welfare reform has contributed to the rise in poverty every year for the past 3 years in the United States, and most dramatically among single mothers and their children. For poor women, the old gender rule, I suppose we're supposed to compare the old rules and the new ones, which was stay home with your children, be domestic, etc., has been replaced by the harsh new reality of working for completely inadequate wages. Now, this is, you know, an attack on women, an attack on children, and it was racist and misogynist in the way it was argued in the mid-90s. But it is also, I would say, a major devaluation of the work of caring for other people. And I do not think, you know, just to reassure Polly, I don't think that's anything intrinsic to women, but it has been traditionally more a woman's thing to do. The welfare reformers in America described women staying home with children as doing nothing. I can only guess that these guys had never been home all day, a rainy day, with two toddlers, or they wouldn't know that. And that the only way a woman could achieve social worth and self-respect is by participating in the labor market. That anything in the labor market, anything you do, is preferable to actually caring for someone in your family. Now, I just want to add in here a non-poverty note, is that I think this same devaluation of caring types of work has occurred among more affluent white-collar workers, too, who now find that a 10 to 12-hour workday is the norm. Now, I don't know if that is true here, but we've had a number of excellent books. Juliet Shore's book, The Overworked American, Jill Fraser's book, The White Collar Sweatshop, about the lengthening of the workday for the white collar professional managerial people. And this is really undermining that feminist notion that we had in the beginnings of the second wave of feminism, that we were going to have it all, meaning have, you know, be able to have fulfilling jobs and well-paid jobs and have families. When we were saying that, we did not think those jobs were going to be 12 hours a day. That's not possible. Here's a quote from an Intel employee from about 2000. She said, "If you make the choice to have a home life, you will be ranked and rated at the bottom." And this is from a professional person. And this suggests to me that one thing we ought to think about is something that could unite blue-collar people, pink-collar people, and white-collar professionals is a movement to take back our time. You know, that it just can't go on like this squeeze. Now, I want to turn away from the gender issue just for a moment to some other quick observations on the shrinking welfare state. And it is shrinking in the United States. In the United States, welfare reform was, in a way, just a warm-up for the big target, which was Social Security, that is, the state pension plan for the elderly. I learned this from a British man, a man named Stuart Butler, who had been, an advisor of some sort to Thatcher. And he came over to the United States in the 80s, and he said this, you know, that... welfare reform, that's small potatoes. That's hardly any money. That's Social Security. That's what we can get rid of here. Would you please take him back if he's still... and this is Bush's highest domestic priority right now, in addition to further tax cuts for the wealthy, is eliminating or privatizing Social Security, which everybody is nervous would be the end of it. In fact, if he doesn't get his way pretty quickly, I can imagine a campaign of defamation directed at the elderly and parallel to the one conducted on welfare mothers in the 1990s. We'll start hearing about depraved old geezers spend their Social Security checks on vodka and Viagra. You know, it'll happen. Now, this rising poverty and a diminishing welfare state is not, I should say, the image that the world has of my country. We are seen, America is seen and largely despised, as a military behemoth, capable of crushing small nations at will. And what is not seen from the outside is the weakness behind that military power, the poverty of America that extends right into the military. A volunteer army, which is what we have, is going to be an army of the poor, the working poor, so-called. Well, I shouldn't have to say that anymore since there's no more non-working poor. It's an example would be Jessica Lynch, the young woman who was the Bush tried to make into a heroine until she herself objected because she'd been kidnapped, I remember, captured by the Iraqis at one point in 2003. And she said, I never wanted to be a soldier. I wanted to be a school teacher. But her family did not have the money to send her to college, and she felt she might get some help by going into the military. By the way, two of the young women who have been accused in the Abu Ghraib torture of prisoners also said the same thing. They hadn't wanted to go in the military, but if you are willing to set aside a certain amount of your limited pay in the military, you can get some help with college. Now, I want to point out something that's been on my mind a lot recently. It's what a historical anomaly this represents. Ever since the introduction of mass armies in the 17th century, in Europe anyway, expanded welfare or expanded social provision of some kind has gone along with militarism in the West. The post-war buildup of the British welfare state, for example, post-World War II buildup. The U.S. welfare state limited as it was, but at least the idea of welfare goes back to widows' pensions that were introduced after the Civil War. You can think of lots of more examples from Bismarck to Hitler of militarism going along with an expanded welfare state. Governments have understood that you have to provide in some way for the class that provides the soldiers. So we have embarked in the United States on what I think it might be a very risky experiment, a warfare state without a welfare state. It places a tragic burden on America's poor, who often find that the only help they can get, health care, housing, things like that, is by signing up to fight in wars that they can't even justify to themselves. An interesting case recently is an African-American woman named Veretta Barnes, who only came to media attention because she had the, I guess, great privilege, I suppose, in the context of being kissed by George Bush when he was in Iraq on his lightning visit around Thanksgiving, that is November 2003. And he was, you know, passing out turkeys to the troops, and he kissed her on the cheek. Anyway, when she returned from Iraq in April 04, her husband had left, her job was gone, her kids had squeezed in with her mother, and there was no room for her there, so she herself was now homeless. The only thing for she could think of to do was to reenlist and go back to Iraq, which is where she is now. Now, this is, you know, a potentially dangerous situation. You do get people like Gulf War I vets Timothy McVeigh and John Muhammad, who are domestic terrorists. Tim McVeigh blew up the federal building in Oklahoma City. John Muhammad was a so-called D.C. area sniper who randomly killed individuals. You have people who have, you know, are completely devalued by their country. They are not offered a college education. They are not offered decent paying jobs. Both of those men had, we know, in real financial trouble when they took up their careers as killers. They get nothing from their government except training in how to kill. And I think that this is potentially is something that ought to worry even Republicans. So I want to end by saying quickly some things that we are doing or trying to do in the progressive end of the political spectrum in the United States. Obviously, we're fighting to defend what's left of the welfare state, which now means Social Security. And I have to say, it is sad to always be in these defensive fights around the welfare state. And yet, I don't see any hope of expansion of the national welfare state whatsoever for the next 4 years. In fact, I worry, actually, what if Bush were to start getting concerned about poverty? What if he decided to do something about poverty? What would he do, bomb it? You know. So another thing we're doing is campaigning to raise wages locally and at the state and county levels. 13 states in the United States have raised their minimum wages. They're not waiting on the federal government. And we also have campaigns to raise minimum wages in cities. And picking up on something Polly was talking about, we're saying that any company that gets subsidies from the public sector, like the city or the county, or that does business in any way with the city, has to pay a living wage as determined for that area. We are also working to support organizations of military families in their demands for more adequate benefits for veterans. And finally, more philosophically, as feminists, I think we are trying to make the point, however we can, that the work of caring for others, which should not be degraded just because it was traditionally female, and I mean caring for children as well as elderly parents, but it is an honorable and necessary social contribution deserving of recognition and ultimately some kind of remuneration. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Barbara, for that talk. It's difficult to describe it as a wonderful talk, given what you were saying, but it was a very illuminating talk, one for which we're all very grateful. What I want to do, first of all, is just to ask each of the speakers if they have a particular question they would like to ask the other, and then we'll open the floor, open the discussion up to the floor.
Yes, I mean, I've found all in all your books, your descriptions of poverty and how people live absolutely hair-raising and appalling. But one of the mysteries is why it doesn't leak out onto the streets more, why it is still in the United States relatively invisible to those who don't want to see it. Why are the people who are not earning enough to buy any groceries, why are they and their children not out there in rags as in Victorian times?
Yeah. Well, I can answer the rags part. We've got Walmart. You can buy. Seriously, 100 years ago, the poor stood out by the difference in their clothing. They don't. You can pass now if you can afford welfare. I mean, afford Walmart, and not everybody can do that. But the other part of the answer is that the growing class segregation in a social sense, too, is that if you are upper middle class, you are not likely to have any contact with poorer people. You don't ride public transportation. You don't send your kids to public schools. You obviously wouldn't use a public hospital if there even is one around. So you interact with low-wage workers as your household help, perhaps, as the people who mow your lawn or something like that. I do fault people for their great lack of curiosity about how those people live. But I think, it's possible to live in an upper middle class bubble.
But they're not actually starving yet. And yet, from your figures, it sounds as if they should be.
I forget the numbers on what they call food insecurity in the United States, the number of families that, where it's really dicey whether you're going to get a meal, be able to put a meal on the table. I'm trying to think of how do we make it vivid? How do we do something that makes it, but puts it in people's faces? Hunger especially. My only idea, which I haven't figured out how to do, but in the 60s and the 50s in the Civil Rights Movement, African Americans sat in at lunch counters to make the point that they had the right to sit there, right? I think it's time to start going into restaurants and just ordering food and not paying for it. That's, just something that you can't avoid. But it's a problem.
Would you like to ask Polly a question?
Yes. I'm wondering, my sense in the United States was that men no longer have such a good deal, the blue-collar men, because of deindustrialization and the flight of manufacturing abroad. So the good, once unionized, blue-collar jobs that, which were allowed a man, and it usually was a man, to support his family without his wife's help, are gone pretty much. So is that a man who a generation ago might have been, say, in the building trades or mining or something, is now driving a forklift in the back of a Walmart store, unloading trucks, maybe get paid slightly more than the women on the floor of the store. But you seemed to be talking about a greater differential here. What's allowing the men to hold on to that?
Well, it's certainly true that we've gone through all the same deindustrialization and a huge swathe of jobs on which whole communities were entirely dependent has gone and went and has devastated those particular communities. It's still true that there's a problem of men who can't earn enough to be good enough breadwinners to be a good proposition. And that's one reason why women aren't marrying, because the men are not worth marrying. They're extra expense. Mm-hmm. They're not.
I've always noticed.
I mean, it's partly. No, I'm not just making a sexist point here. I'm also saying it's partly the way the social security system works. Mm-hmm. If you live on your own, you can have all that money for yourself and your children. If you live with a partner, it all becomes much more difficult. And the part that the partner actually gets from social security is very little. There are a lot of reasons why men are no longer really very marriageable if you're poor. And it is partly that those jobs have gone. But the pay differential is real. I mean, there as well. And although there are lots of low-paid men, the majority of the jobs are women's jobs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so there is a sort of lethal intersection between low pay and being a woman mm-hmm. that is much worse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, but I was fascinated what you said, that it's not just motherhood, that it starts for the single woman.
entering into the same job as a man.
That surprised me, because and particularly that it's true of people leaving universities as well. It mm-hmm. goes back to the choices of what women choose to do. And if you look at the subjects they do, they're not doing the maths and the physics and the chemistry. It's partly because they're projecting ahead sometimes to jobs where they think they'll be able to manage children and work later on. Mm-hmm. So they think, well, if I'm a teacher, or you know, so that they will take, if amongst educated women, will often tend to take options where they're already taking into account that they may want to have a family-friendly life. Mm-hmm. So for a number of different reasons, it happens all the way through.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think one additional reason I would add there is just a word on behalf of men, is that the low-paid men work extremely long hours, especially fathers, which sort of boosts their income to some degree, which is another factor. But let's open the discussion to the floor now. A microphone will come to you when I indicate that I'd like to hear your point. We've got a question on the back row there. Thank you.
Hi, I'm very interested in the issue of poverty in military families. And I'm wondering, right now, people for the war and against the war, everyone seems to be united right now, at least in the States, about supporting our troops and not letting it be about them. So I think this would be a really good time. I know starting wages in the military in the United States are very basic. You can start out, I think, like $12,000 a year plus benefits. But if you think there could be a movement right now to increase the base wage for the military in the U.S., and if the military pay in the U.K., if you know if it's a living wage, and if people, because there are all these reports right now in the States about, you know, one partner's abroad in Iraq and the family has to, you know, apply for welfare back home, and they're getting free food because they can't support their family. So if that's a problem in the U.K., and if we can maybe take this time to increase it. You know,
wait, did you say it's a problem in the U.K.
No, I'm asking if it's a problem in the U.K. and why you think there's something more done politically right now to support our troops in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we have to do more. I mean, it's great to take that support our troops slogan and throw it back at the Bush administration. He did do one good thing for the troops. You know what food stamps is in the United States? The federal program, which the working poor also can get, to enable you to buy food. Last year, Bush ruled that when a soldier gets an extra amount of pay for combat duty, which is about $200 a month, his or her family would no longer lose their eligibility for food stamps. Think about it. Before that, you know, if you were in combat, you could be increasing your family's chances of going without food. But what they're talking about now is interesting. I'm surprised they've taken this up. The death benefit for the family of a soldier killed is $12,000. And now Congress people are tripping over themselves to say that should be increased, say, to $100,000, which I think is very nice, but, you know, it's kind of ghoulish, too, that that's the only way you could come close to such, an amount of money in your life is by giving your life. But I agree, this is a very important thing to focus on.
Now, the pay in the British Army is nothing like as bad as that. We have the same thing. If you look at where people are recruited from, they're recruited very heavily from areas of the old industrial deserts. But it's nothing like as acute as that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, perhaps I'd like to take a range of questions. Can I have some sort of indication of who wants to ask them at some point? Okay, we'll have one on the top row at the upstairs at the back. And I'll take your question as well.
Thank you. I'm having a lot of thoughts about the issue of money, in that money drives our society so dramatically these days, if not almost solely, drives policy and everything. In turn, the fact that women are low paid does show what society does value and doesn't value, because it doesn't have, you can't put a monetary value, as you said, on love and caring. And that reflects where our priorities are and what we do value, which has to be monetary. If there could be a shift, say, towards a greater emphasis on happiness and what truly goes into happiness, then I think as a fundamental underlying vision, a lot of the policy issues would shift accordingly and start to resolve some of these huge issues. I'd like to know what you think about that.
Okay, and one at the front here.
If we could just get a few.
Okay. My question was for Ms. Ehrenreich about what you said about progressives in the United States taking action at more local levels, at state and county levels. And I know that this is a movement in the United States because for the next 4 years, it seems like very little can be done nationally for issues of poverty, gender inequality, right on to women's reproductive rights and so on. Do you think that's a dangerous route to take? In some way, it's sort of borrowing the enemy's strategy because the state's rights traditionally are a Republican idea. I think that's dangerous and it will create more inequality, but geographically based, where you'll live in a progressive area, therefore you have better wages, or you'll live in an area that's perhaps a red state, blue state divide.
Can I just take one more, just sort of there? Yeah, and the gentleman behind, and then we'll respond.
Well, that was riveting as ever, Barbara. I just wondered, though, in your stressing of the importance of caring work and valuing caring, which is, of course, terribly important, I do think, as well, you have to go a little further as to how we're able to care, because, as you and Ali other people know, a lot of people work long hours because caring work can be so difficult and depressing if you don't have any resources to help you doing the caring work. So we have to also refer to some of those other 1970s ideas about what resources there are for assisting people in caring work, so that you don't just get more poor and lonely housewives, which is what we had before encouraging women to stay at home.
Mm-hmm. Okay, one more there, and then we'll respond to those.
I just had a question about another group that tends to get very marginalised in the labour market, which is migrant and immigrant workers, and whether you think it reveals anything about attitudes about the type of work that is being done, or whether there are more deep-seated opinions about the type of worker who is doing the work, and just whether that group reveals anything about the gender inequalities as well.
Okay. Polly, do you want to respond?
Well, I think the question of migrant workers is very interesting in that our government here has been quite keen to open the door to let more migrant workers in. And certainly George Bush came to power very keen to do that too. And of course, it does depress wages. For people on the progressive side of politics, this is always something of a dilemma. And because we have progressive trade unions, they've really had nothing to say about this. But I think it's undoubtedly true. Look at London and how many people, a lot of them Eastern Europeans, wherever it is they've come from, are doing jobs that are very low paid. I imagine most of them with just about minimum wage. And if you shut the door, the price would have to rise. That's a dilemma. And it's a dilemma for me. And I don't know what I think about it because... I like the idea of an open door in a society that is welcoming, but on the other hand, it's certainly been an engine for depressing wages. Mm-hmm. Though I do think there are all these other engines, like cartel thinking, that work too. I think there are an awful lot of things that you could do before you had to say, right, we're going to shut the door and not allow any foreign workers in. Mm-hmm. And the happiness question.
Yeah.
Richard Layard is your man. He gave a brilliant set of lectures here. Like a lot of people who spend a lot of their life on economics, there are a whole school of economists who are turning towards hedonics on the grounds that they discovered that they did help, or at least observed, huge amounts of more money being made and countries getting richer and richer, and very few of them getting any happier. And although it's quite difficult to do measurements that are reasonably comparable between countries about how happy people are, at least by doing those tests over a number of years, you begin to see what direction people are moving. In nearly all of the OECD developed countries have got no happier as they've got twice or three times richer over many years. The only ones that got happier are the ones that distributed their wealth more fairly. Again, the Nordic countries actually are the only ones who got happier. They're the only ones who've bucked the trend in having more children, because having children seemed to them a good thing, and it hasn't seemed to them a very good thing to the women in the rest of the developed world. So that very high social spending, very good quality services of all kinds from the state, paying very high taxes, and being paid not that differently whether you're a doctor or a cleaner, seems to contribute to a growing sense of well-being and happiness in a country. It is a very difficult message to get across. It's very hard to say to people, even though they will say, you know, we know money isn't really what the world's about. We know money isn't what makes people happy. They're still not willing to believe those sorts of figures.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, Barbara, there's the resources question and then the one more specifically to the
Which
US.
Which one was that?
There's a question of resources for caring. And then.
Oh, okay. I agree, Lynn. No, I think, you know, ideally we'd want to have lots of social options, you know, daycare centers for the elderly, really high-quality childcare centers, you know, so that those are options too. But what gets me in the United States is this pro-family rhetoric from the right combined with complete and total contempt for anything that goes into taking care of the family. So I was just at that rather non-utopian level, as I am forced to be. And to go to your question about is it potentially sort of conservative to have to focus on the state and the local level? Well, I don't know what else to do. And there is some leverage. There was an interesting thing that happened in Florida in November. On the ballot at the same time as the presidential election was a measure to raise the Florida minimum wage from $5.15 an hour, which is the national minimum wage, quite a bit less than yours, I must say. And, or maybe that's just because the dollar isn't worth anything anymore. But but there was another, so there was a measure to raise that Florida minimum wage to, I think, $6.15 an hour. Now, on that in that vote, Bush reportedly won 52%. Reportedly, who knows? But anyway, we'll accept that 52%. 72% voted to raise the minimum wage, which means there were a lot of people who thought Bush was saving us from terrorism and who yet recognized the complete, you know, the scandal of having so many people work for these subsistence wages. And that's the kind of leverage we have to look for.
Okay, so can I have an indication of who else is Professor Held and down at the front here to take one?
I wonder where you both see political leverage in the future with dealing with these entrenched, further entrenching patterns. And I wonder whether you see any hope in generational change, and what in particular what I have in mind is the astonishing progress of girls in education, schools and universities in the last two decades all across the OECD world. I mean, over 15 years ago, I think young women were a minority in the dominant Ivy League schools in the United States, in Harvard Law School, Harvard Medical School, Harvard Business School, and so on. And now they represent over 50% of the student body. This extraordinary accumulation of educational success across nearly every subject, but not all subjects, and across most of the leading professions now, might represent some serious cultural momentum. One of the great triumphs of the 60s and 70s is the young girls now whose expectations have been so systematically raised. I wonder whether you think this has durable political value in an age when the trends seem to be getting more entrenched.
There's a question here, and then one over there.
I just wanted to ask about temporary workers and what your views are on
put the rise closer to you, ma'am.
Sorry, on your views on the rise of temporary workers in the UK, and I don't know about the US, but we certainly have a lot of temporary workers. I've worked in the public sector for 2 years since I left university, and I'm only now in my first full-time permanent role within the NHS. And I just wondered what your views were on that.
Okay, and there was one over there.
Yeah, I want to two comments and a question. You talk about the political choice, Polytonic B, and I come from Scandinavia. I lived here for 5 years, and I was up. I thought I was moving to a country that was fairly similar, and I must say the inequality here is staggering. I mean, I had no idea, although I had been reading Financial Times for 6 years previously to moving here. I don't want to be sort of too Scandinavian arrogant, but there is.
Go ahead.
Thank you. There is the experience from Scandinavia shows so clearly and so well that the fundament for women and to the women's participation is good quality, affordable childcare. You know, I don't believe in simple solutions, but this is such a simple solution. and it has actually worked. So I'm just wondering, why aren't British women out on the streets screaming for it? I can't understand that. And then one comment to what the Professor Held was saying, that yes, I definitely, like, 30 years ago, I believed in the power of education. I've just been talking to somebody that is actually also in Scandinavia, who had been doing some sort of looking into this effect, because there we have actually had well-educated women now for about 30 years. And funnily enough, you know, we the universities are flooded with women pushing out the men. So you, in all these respects, the women are so strongly in education. Funnily enough, now, if you talk to people who are hiring people, suddenly it's not the education which matters. It's some, like, you know, undefinable qualities like initiative and stuff like that. So finally, when we had the goal in front of us, it was proof.
Okay. I think you're right. I think that one of the depressing things that's happened, though, is women seem to have got more educated and got more sucked into a very, very long hours culture of work. There has been no time for any kind of political engagement or anything of that kind. The complete disappearance of any feminist movement in this country is really depressing. Lynn, you will agree. There was a time when, a very exciting time in the early 70s, when, you know, huge swathes of women did actually get up and say no, and we won't put up with this. And a lot got changed quite easily. It took a relatively small amount of leverage to change a huge number of things, to get through the Equal Pay, the Sex Discrimination Act, and a lot of other things, to change the trade unions, to change all kinds of ways that people thought. And that really has vanished. Childcare, we're getting there. I mean, childcare, it was very much the Labour women MPs, the new generation who came, who made most noise about that. And we're really getting there. We're getting there too slowly. It isn't clear to me yet that it's all going to be universal and high quality and soon enough. Having been to Sweden, where childcare workers, every other childcare worker is a graduate with a pedagogic degree, 3 years training, and the childcare is fantastically high quality. It's certainly the government's intention and aspiration, and they believe in it. Whether they will go on believing it and go on investing in it and making sure that it is that kind of high quality, I have my doubts. An awful lot of it at the moment is rather low quality, privately provided, looks quite glossy, actually not very good. So we've got to be sure and keep pushing, and I wish there was a bigger, a louder voice and groups of women, as they used to be, to be protesting about that. Women in education, I don't know, things should be getting better, but I think the moving the goalpost point is a very good one. And I think that managing children, you've only got to fall back part-time for a few years, and your career is pretty much wiped out. And you find women going into the highways and byways of every occupation rather than on the straight ladder up. Forgotten what the other. Temporary agency workers. Well, in theory, the government has signed up in an agreement with the trade unions at Warwick last summer to doing something about this and to doing something about making sure that outsourced workers, so that if you do work in the NHS for an agency, you should at least get the same pay and conditions as if you're directly employed by the NHS. It's not there yet. These things are taking a while to work through, but at least it's been agreed in principle.
Sorry, what about the fact that the taxpayers are paying double to employ these workers as opposed to employing contract workers, and also the employment rights of people in temp are shocking, really bad?
Oh, absolutely shocking, absolutely.
The question was about the rights of temporary workers, just to follow up.
Agency workers. I mean, I agree. I think that the rights are disgraceful. The idea of resisting the EU directive on this, because there is a directive on equal rights for agency workers, has been very depressing indeed.
Okay, Barbara?
Well, as I'd like to, in prime minute. Sometimes we do get out in the streets and yell and scream for childcare. The last time I was arrested for disorderly conduct, actually it was disorderly conduct. It was at a demonstration. I was arrested with 100 other women who are workers at Yale University demanding childcare. We had a big demonstration, and then 100 of us got arrested in a sort of ritualized way. But anyway, just to know that we were out there on this. On the women's education issue, you make an interesting point about just as we get an education, they change what they want. I've spent the last year doing research for another kind of book where I went undercover as a white-collar corporate job seeker. And I had a really good fake resume, and, I was, really well-educated and skilled and everything. It's not what they want. They want a team player. They want somebody who's not only upbeat but passionate. And these things seem to count much more than skill in the corporate world today, which is terrifying about even, the continuance of capitalism. If it's all run by a bunch of passionate backslappers, But as far as, I agree with David, the importance of women's education. In fact, I have my own plan for a war on terrorism, but nobody listens to me. I hate the expression war on terrorism. It means nothing, but we're, what I mean. Anyway, which is the United States should just start funding girls' education and secular education for boys in Pakistan, Bangladesh, and other places. If girls' education would be so important there. I mean, I can't think of a single more decisive thing we could do to undercut the Islamist the misogynist sort of Islamist insurgency.
We did have one good idea, a few of us, for demonstrations during the elections about childcare. We thought we would hand politicians babies to kiss and then run away. You won't catch them kissing any babies now.
Would you leave your child with Newt Gingrich or Donald Rumsfeld, huh?
Do we have any last very quick questions? This must be the last round. We have one there. One at the top. Yes, thank you very much. So 1, 2, 3, 4 down there, okay? You've got it, right.
Hi. Just quickly about sort of the relationship, at least in America, between reproductive rights and poverty. I mean, there's such a fight against reproductive rights and then sort of no support for women when they do have children.
Don't forget the person right at the back up there. Oh, was there another one up there as well? Okay, and one at the front up there. Ashley, be quite brief with your questions.
Yes, thank you very much. Just a very quick comment that I think a sort of approach towards migration and race issues to the analysis of gender inequality would add a lot more. That's just a brief comment. The question is actually about solidarity. And I wonder about solidarity with other, quote, marginalized groups within the US, for example, but also in the UK. And I'm wondering, is there something, some kind of ideas you have for the future? Just let me take a counterpoint, and that is the Christian Coalition. Maybe it's more important to focus on the coalition aspect of the success. What is the coalition that we could build on the other side, in other words, in both the UK and the US, a coalition that would engage, you know, different groups that are, quote, marginalized? And I'm again thinking of women of color. I'm thinking of sexual minorities. I'm thinking of, obviously, migrants, migrant workers' rights. And your dilemma, which you point out to Polly about migrant workers' rights, could hopefully be addressed if we had better regulation for their rights in this country. Thank you.
I'll have that one up there. And then
with both of you here, I was curious, having read each other's work, what is a notable difference, or what you would consider important difference or similarity between the daily lives of low-income workers in the US and the UK?
Thank you. And there were two questions down. Oh, well, thank you. Thanks.
Women are grossly unrepresented in the UK in the House of Commons. Given that that's the situation, surely that's one of the more fundamental problems we should address in addition to education if we're going to resolve this problem.
Was there one other?
Yeah, just
yeah, thank
right here.
You. Right.
Like in defense of the Bush administration's appeal to privatize half of the Social Security system, would you not feel that in some sense, or maybe in a large sense, it could have the same maybe success rate as IDAs, individual development accounts? That was kind of like a Republican means to address a deficit of black home ownership and their saving investment rate in the African American community, of course, in the United States. And just more so going back to like the Civil Rights Movement and the 1970s movement for black capitalism, looking at ways to sustain a solid black middle class, you know, with the ability to save and invest half of your pension in different ventures, as opposed to simply relying on government to, you know, pretty much have this nest egg for you.
So, okay, Barbara first.
Reproductive rights and women's poverty, yes. Yeah. Very much linked. And we have a challenge now, you know, to provide, actually raise money so poor women can get abortions. That's what it's come to. Fundraising for that. On the issue of solidarity and uniting different groups, I would I give you just two examples, because we do very much think that way. One comes from the state I now live in, Virginia. There's a group called the Virginia Organizing Project, which organizes low-wage people around housing issues, welfare issues, racial profiling, all kinds of things. What's interesting to me is that they always bring up gay rights. You know, and I'm so impressed by that. They do that when they're in the far western Appalachian part of the state, which is it's rough. They do that when they're in the coastal, much more black part of the state. And I said, you know, aren't you, you know, taking a risk by doing that? They said, this is important. You know, it's the high school students who work with us who insist that we always, you know, that we try to make those links. And so I think there's very much a consciousness illustrated by things like that. Another a very touching thing that happened last spring in Fort Wayne, Indiana. The university was building a new, great big new building. And instead of turning to the local construction trades workers, mostly white males, they brought in undocumented Mexican workers, who they then paid $6 an hour and worked from dawn
to dusk. The building trades workers were furious about the loss of jobs, but they came to the decision that what they had to do was reach out to the Mexican workers. So I went to an event in August, which had these building trade workers who were, you know, easy to stereotype as sort of Archie Bunker types or something if you were unsophisticated, and the Mexican workers. And I think there is a growing consciousness. The AFL-CIO, the trade union movement, understands you organize immigrants. You just fight against their coming. Now, we have to do a lot more, like, you know, why do we have so many immigrants coming from Mexico? The destruction of the Mexican economy, in part by NAFTA. You know, and we understand how NAFTA drags down working class conditions in the United States and in Mexico. So we're trying to put it all together. I would just add, on the Social Security point, I think there are better ways to generate capital for investment than taking the money that is supposed to be for your old age. This is the worry. We've seen the stock market go up and down. We've seen in the 90s times when people made enormous sums off it. Then we saw them lose catastrophically in 2001. And there they are, a lot of people then who have very little by way of savings for their old age. Our idea is that there should be one thing that's guaranteed. Increase, you know, venture capital for black businesses, for women-run businesses, but don't do it at the expense of people's security in old age, would be my point.
Polly, can you take the key difference in political representation and I'll wrap it up?
Political representation, yes, of course. It's still only 18% in the House of Commons are women, many more Labour than Conservative. It's very depressing. It's been so slow. The men fight very hard to hold on to their seats. I don't know what more we could do about it. I think the Labour Party has done quite well with having at least all women shortlists in some constituencies. When it comes to Barbara's books, which I think are just terrific, I actually come away thinking, actually, things aren't so bad here after all. I listen to your conversation, to what you have to say about it, and I'm always so absolutely dumbstruck by how appalling America is and how dreadful it is and how little it enters into the equation when people talk about how rich America is, that actually America is two quite different countries. And our understanding of America is bizarre, partly because we do talk about a meaningless sum like per capita income, which doesn't mean anything at all. And I'm always returned thinking, well, things aren't bad here at all. And actually, we do have the best government we've had in my political lifetime. We've had more progress made on poverty, on women's rights, on things for women, than have been made under any previous government in my political lifetime. I've just been writing a book trying to balance up the things that have been so good about what they've done with the things so much better that they could have done. And that they've been, you know, a government in fantastically propitious times who have been very unambitious in lots of ways, and particularly unambitious about some of the things we've been talking about how do you persuade people, how do you change people's minds, that a lot of the best things they've done by stealth, they've done secretly. So this week we've had a very good, what looks set to be a very good reform of incapacity benefit, but it was accompanied by speeches from Tony Blair and others saying, you know, more or less, we're going to stop the scroungers and beat the hell out of them. There was the general impression given was that this was something incredibly tough that was going to happen to the poor people who were on incapacity benefit. But what actually came out was sensible, good, progressive, and should be helpful. And unless we have politicians who are braver in putting forward ideas about equality, we won't change the underlying way that people think. We won't help people understand the society that they're actually living in.
Okay, well, on that note, I have to draw proceedings to a close. But before you go, I'd like to remind you that next week we have Branko Milanovic, who's giving a lecture on global inequality in this Miliband series, and followed by Nancy Fraser on the 8th of March, concerned with framing justice in the modern world. But I would really like to thank both speakers very much for a very illuminating